Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And in case you are not aware, I want to remind you all that you can now get the app from your phone, from your iPhone or other phone, thanks to Audio Now. And Progressive Radio Network is available for you to take with you and listen wherever you go. So you can check out the archives, you can listen live. So go to your app store and download our new app, the Progressive Radio Network. I have a great show planned for all of you today. Mary Lawrence will be my guest. She's the author of Eat Vegan With Me, Creating Community Through Conversation and Compassionate Cuisine. And I'm really excited to introduce her to all of you. Of course, I have a recipe to share. But before I do that, I want to share with you some things going on around the news and some things coming up. I just spent the last 3 days down in Washington, D.C., helping my daughter move down there. She's going to be a curator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, and that's a really great new position for her. But while I was down there, we got to visit the Obama and Barack Obama and Michelle Obama's portraits at the National Portrait Gallery, and that was lovely. But what I also got to witness was the huge display of 7,000 pairs of shoes on the front lawn of the Capitol. And that was just so moving. I also drove by it yesterday morning, really couldn't see the shoes because it was filled with so many students. There was a huge walkout, in case you don't know, yesterday morning at 10 a.m. across the country. And it was a walkout for 17 minutes, 1 minute for each of the students that were killed in Parkland High School. And the momentum building for gun control is really at a huge, crucial climax right now. And it's wonderful to have all these students speaking out and planning the March of Our Lives, which is coming up on March 24th, which is going to be another march and rally across the country. The big one, of course, is in Washington, D.C., but cities across the country. I mean, there has to be at least 20 just on Long Island, where I live, and a big one in New York City, Washington, D.C., but all the major cities. March for Our Lives on March 24th is a huge march to raise awareness and ask our Congress to enact laws that will help protect us from gun violence. And there's many things they're asking for. They're asking for background checks. They're asking for raised ages in buying them. They're asking for regulations on assault weapons. They're asking for the bump stocks to not be legal. There's so many different requests, but right now the number of kids that have been killed in schools is just horrendous. And, you know, gun violence in this country, I mean, you know, there's all these travel warnings when you travel to other places, but the reality is this country's more dangerous than many of the other countries that have travel warnings. So we really need to do something about it. So I hope you'll join with the students in this movement for March of Our Lives on March 24th. Lots of other great things are coming up. Tomorrow is the 6th Annual Massachusetts Urban Farming Conference. That is Friday and Saturday up at Bunker Hill Community College outside of Boston. March 17th, Plant a Roll for the Hungry at the Port Washington Library on Long Island. But Plant a Roll for the Hungry is a movement across the country. This is just one workshop locally to encourage people to do that. But that is a movement that we all can participate in. If you're growing vegetables, and even if you're not, you can consider doing it, planting some vegetables that you then donate to food pantries. As we all know, food pantries, you know, get lots of donations from, you know, big mega corporations that are shelf-stable products like, you know, pasta and rice and beans and canned vegetables and soups and all that kind of stuff. But they don't get fresh fruits and vegetables, and that's what they really need to eat in order to become healthy. We all know about the obesity and diabetes epidemics that are going on, and a lot of it is in underserved communities. They have much higher rates, and part of it is because of their diet. A huge part of it is because of their diet. So if we can all help by donating some fresh vegetables to our local food pantries, that would be a great step in the right direction. So on March 17th, there is a workshop for that in Port Washington at 2 p.m., but you can do it anywhere where you live. So do give that some thought. March 22nd, there's a workshop called Busting Food Myths. Dr. Robert Graham, who is a board-certified integrative doctor, he's also the founder of Fresh Med New York City and a chef in training at the Natural Culinary Institute, along with Stephanie Sachs, who I have interviewed. I actually interviewed Dr. Robert Graham as well on this show. And Stephanie Sachs, who's a culinary nutritionist and founder of Reboot Food and author of What the Fork Are You Eating. Together, they're going to be presenting a workshop from 7 to 9 at Organic Crush in Woodbury on Long Island. And they are just going to be talking about the real issues around food. So if you are looking to eat healthier, that might be a workshop you would like to participate in. And I already said the March for Our Lives event taking place around the country. Check it, just Google March for Your Lives and it will come up for you and you'll be able to find a march that you can participate in close to your home. On March 25th, Slow Food East End is having a movable feast, and this is a fundraiser to support the Edible School Garden Program out there. And Sam Cass, who was Obama's chef at the White House, and he's a food entrepreneur, along with Richard McCarthy, who is the executive director of Slow Food USA. He will moderate, and there's going to be just a discussion out in Sag Harbor at Dodds and Etter Landscape Design Showroom. It's a great fundraiser, wonderful program, and it's celebrating the legacy of Joshua Levine, who was a farmer out at Quail Hill Farm, one of the first CSAs in the country. And he was unfortunately killed in a farm accident there. And so they set up this this wonderful foundation in memory of him that supports the Edible School Garden Program out on the East End. So come out and show your support for that. Just Food Conference, their annual conference is coming up on Sunday, March 25th. This is always a huge, wonderful conference. It will take place up at Columbia Teachers College. And again, that's Sunday, March 25th. You can go onto Just Food website, justfood.org, and find out more information about that. March 28th, the Pro Bono Partnership, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization that connects nonprofits with free legal counsel. They are having a free workshop called Starting a Nonprofit, Upsides, Downsides, and Alternatives on Wednesday, March 28th from 9 to 11 at the Miller Business Resource Center on Long Island. And the Pro Bono Partnership is a great organization. They work with nonprofits in Connecticut, New York, and I believe New Jersey, too. So check them out. March 31st is the Green Thumb Growers Conference, sponsored by New York City Green Parks. And this is their 40th anniversary of the New York City Green Parks. And they're kicking off the season by honoring their roots. And Karen Washington, who is a longtime activist and pioneer for community gardens and food justice, she will be the keynote speaker there. It's from 8 to 4, and it's only $5. So come on out to that. It's at the Borough of Manhattan Community College. There's also a food justice certified training course coming up. That's for people already working in certifying organic food, but it's really actually for anybody. Anyone can participate. If you're interested in becoming a food justice certified trainer, you can check that out. It's from April 2nd to 5th out at the Woolman Hill Quaker Retreat Center. And I have information on all of these events on my website. So if you don't get it right now, you can go onto my website at ieatgreen.com and find out all of this information. April 14th is the 6th Annual Sustainable Garden Conference out at Farmingdale State College. That's always a wonderful event. And coming up on April 19th, the Long Island Food Coalition is having a conference out at Hofstra. It's called The State of Long Island Local Suburban Agriculture, Where Do We Go From Here? Or Where Do We Grow From Here? And that's from 9 to 1 out at Hofstra University. And I'll have more information about that also on my website. So check all those things out. They're really wonderful. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that I ask my listeners to take action to find out, you know, ways that they can get involved. You know, the 2018 Farm Bill is coming up, and that is always something that I bring to my listeners' attention, because the Farm Bill not only controls SNAP benefits for those in need, but it also, you know, provides farm insurance to farmers and supports sustainable growing methods, although it doesn't support it enough, and that's one of the things we are asking the Farm Bill to do. So there's ways that you can be helpful. The Union of Concerned Scientists has a great article on the 2018 Farm Bill, so if you go to their website, you can read about that there. But just be aware that the Farm Bill is happening, and there's ways that you can get involved. Let your congressman know that you would like them to support sustainable growers in this new Farm Bill, and healthy school lunch programs as well in this Farm Bill. McDonald's had made a commitment years ago that they were going to cut out using chicken that has antibiotics. We're asking them to also make a commitment to use antibiotic-free pork and beef in their products. Of course, I don't like McDonald's at all and support fast food at all, but it is here, and I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. So while it is here, let's ask them to put some pressure on the ranchers that they treat their animals in a more humane way and do not treat them with antibiotics and hormones. So you can find out more about that on my website as well. We also want to say no to Arctic drilling, and there's a petition on my website to sign up for that as well. This is also the time that you want to start planting your seeds in your greenhouse, if you have a greenhouse, or even just indoors on a windowsill, any of those plants that need a long season. Or, you know, you can find a place where you can buy the organic seedlings. But things like eggplants, peppers, tomatoes, they need to be started inside because they just require a longer growing season than we have up here on the in the Northeast. But things like your snow peas and sugar snap peas and arugula, radishes, those can go in really soon. As soon as the snow melts and the soil gets soft enough to dig into, usually St. Patty's Day is the day that I think of for my sugar snap peas and snow peas. So you want to start getting out there into the garden again, and I'm so excited to do that. So I want to share with all of you my recipe for this week, which is a black lentil dal with sog tofu. And it came out just really, really great. And it was inspired by a recipe in the New York Times last week. But I wanted to make mine, of course, vegan without any dairy. And I also wanted to add some protein. So, of course, the lentils are protein, but I wanted to also add some tofu and some greens into it. So I felt like it was more of a complete meal. And dal, I always think of more as a side dish, even though I'm sure a lot of people don't. I always like, you know, dal with a vegetable curry and rice. So anyway, this made that dal side dish into a full meal, and it really came out great. So I started with 1 cup of black lentils that I rinsed, 1/2 cup of red lentils, 1 1/2 jalapeno peppers, 1 large onion chopped, 2 tablespoons plus 1/4 cup of coconut oil, 1 can of fire-roasted tomatoes with chili peppers. And so I got the can of fire-roasted tomatoes with chili peppers from Trader Joe's. You can also get a can that doesn't have chili peppers, and it won't be as spicy. I used 1 1/2 jalapeno peppers. If I was using just a can of fire-roasted tomatoes that didn't have chili peppers, I probably would have used the whole two jalapeno peppers in the recipe. But it depends on you. That's one of the beauties when you're the chef and you're doing the cooking. You can adjust the spices to what you like. So if you really don't like any spice, you can leave the jalapeno peppers out totally and just use a bell pepper. That would work fine as well. I used 1 block of organic extra firm tofu, 1 teaspoon of cayenne pepper. Also, you can leave that out if you don't like spice. 2 teaspoons coriander, 1 1/2 teaspoons of fenugreek, 1 teaspoon of salt, and you can, I'm going light on the salt, but you can do more to your taste. 4 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1/3 cup chopped garlic, 2-inch piece of ginger that I minced, 1 teaspoon of coriander, 1 can coconut milk, one bag of frozen chopped spinach, and 2 tablespoons of cilantro, plus some for garnish. And also, same with cilantro. If you're one of those people that really doesn't like cilantro, you can leave it out, and you can substitute parsley if you'd like. So I started by washing the lentils well and draining them, and then I soaked them in 2 cups of water for about an hour, and then I drained them again. And then I put the lentils in a large stock pot with 3 cups of water, and I brought that to a boil. And then I skimmed off the top. You know, like when you first boil it, a lot of dirt and scum kind of comes to the top. So you take that off and then drain it again and put it back into a stock pot with another 3 cups of water. And the jalapeno peppers I put in there too, and half of the minced ginger. And then I simmered those lentils for about 45 minutes, stirring constantly so that the bottom didn't stick until they started to get soft. And while that was happening, in a large, heavy, you know, in my cast iron frying pan, I sauteed my onions in 1 tablespoon of coconut oil until they were translucent. Then I pushed the onions to the side, put another tablespoon of coconut oil in the middle, and I put in the garlic and the tofu. And I cooked that until the tofu got golden brown. And then I removed the tofu and the onions from the pan and set that aside. And then to the same pan, I added 1/4 cup of coconut oil along with the fire-roasted tomatoes and the tomato paste. And I cooked down the tomato paste a little bit till it really got toasted and cooked well. So I did that for about a few minutes. And then I added the seasoning, the cayenne pepper, the coriander, the fenugreek, the remaining garlic and ginger, and I continued cooking that for about another 5 minutes. Then I added the coconut milk. I returned the tofu and the onions to the pan and let that simmer for about 10 minutes. Then I took the whole cast iron frying pan with the tofu mixture and added it to the pot of lentils, along with the bag of frozen spinach, and I stirred that up and let that simmer in the pot for about 30 minutes. I added the cilantro, and I tasted and adjusted the spices. If you want a little more salt or a little more fenugreek, you can just do that. And that's it. Serve it up with some saffron rice, and it's a complete meal. You have your greens, you have your tofu, you have lentils. It was just really, really delicious. So I hope you make it, and I hope you let me know that you made it and that you loved it, and I love feedback. So I look forward to hearing from you on this recipe. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Mary Lawrence. Mary is a vegan chef and a wellness educator who works with many different clients, including self-described omnivores who enthusiastically proclaim that they never knew vegan food could taste so good. She's a board member of the American Vegan Society and a frequent speaker at conferences and events, including the North American Vegetarian Society's annual Summerfest. Mary holds a certificate in plant-based nutrition from the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies at Cornell University. She has an MA in communication and a BA in English. And through cooking classes and engaging conversations, she really helps make vegan transition easy, affordable, and delicious for her many clients and for the people that read her books. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mary to all of you. Mary, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have you on my show to talk about your book and your passion. So can you start by just telling us what led you to become a vegan?
Sure, yeah. And I do have to say that curry that you just described sounds so amazing. It's one of my favorites.
It really came out great. You know, I make Indian food a lot, but, you know, I rely a lot on, you know, I do curry powder, cumin. This didn't have any cumin, any curry powder. You know, it was just, it was great. It was using, fenugreek more, and I'm not as familiar with that, and it was just delicious.
Me too. I'm going to have to try that. So my history, let's see, for health reasons. So 20 years ago, I had major health problems. I won't get into all the details, but tired all the time, no energy, really bad sinus congestion. I like to say I had seasonal allergies that essentially lasted all 4 seasons. They just never went away. So I went to traditional doctors, and they said to me that I needed to do 2 things. 1, be on medication the rest of my life, and 2, get rid of my dog, because they said I was allergic to my dog, neither of which I wanted to do. So I started doing research, and really back then, 20 years ago, there was no internet. So it was really kind of a challenge to find any alternative. But I did find a naturopathic doctor, and essentially she said I needed to change everything that I was eating. And at the time, I had never made the connection before about the food that I was eating and the way I was feeling, because everyone I knew was eating the same things I was eating, but I was a really bad junk food addict. That was the problem. And so I gave up all processed foods, refined sugar, refined flour, dairy, meat, and various other things, you know, fried foods, things like that. So initially it was for health reasons. And within 3 months, so it took some time for me to detox because I was so unhealthy. And within 3 months, I had regained my health. And at the time, I was just thinking it was a diet change. It was just, I wasn't referring to myself as vegan. I just figured I would do this and then I could go back to eating pizza and all that stuff again. But the more research I did and the more I learned about the animal agriculture industry, I just decided I didn't want to contribute to that anymore. So even though it started initially for health reasons, I stuck with it for ethical reasons. And the more I learn, really, it's like constantly doing research. And we get information now on the internet all the time and find out how, you know, badly animals are treated, how much it, how animal agriculture affects the environment. So I stick with it for all those reasons. And to me, I don't want to be a part of that anymore. So that's my long history. And I feel just so glad that I had that health crisis and so glad that I didn't listen to my doctor and get rid of my dog. I kept my dog, of course. And really, she was my motivation to stay healthy and to heal myself. And that's what I learned, that, you know, there are times when you do need medication, but when you can find out the underlying cause of whatever your health issue is, and that's why I discovered the food was the underlying cause, and the stress in my life and the fact that I wasn't exercising. So all those things contributed to my poor health. And when I discovered that I could essentially heal myself without taking medication, that really is my focus.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you were eating processed food, so you weren't cooking very much fast before you became vegan, were you?
I was not a cook and didn't know anything about cooking. I was married at the time. My husband was more of the cook. So I learned from him essentially how to cook. And that was my start. And really thinking, I'm part Italian, part Lithuanian. So thinking about traditional foods that my family ate, like lots of, you know, pasta, cheese-based dishes. So I tried to come up with vegan versions. So it was really veganizing foods that I knew that I loved. But then I also explored other cultures. I'd never had Indian food before, but once I discovered it, I just really enjoyed it. And so it was really an adventure of experiencing new flavors. And I started to experiment, but I realized I needed more training. So I did go back to school. I was a teacher at the time. Went back to school, got a culinary arts certificate, and really kind of thought I would open a restaurant at the time. When I worked in a restaurant, it was just too stressful of an environment for me. So instead, I started teaching cooking classes, teaching people how to eat healthy and make simple vegan recipes. And that
Where
really
did you get
is,
your culinary arts certificate from?
I went to a community college. I kept it simple. I wanted to stay in the area. I wasn't sure exactly what I would be doing with it, but I knew that I wanted to develop some skills, you know, knife skills and understanding how ingredients work together. And I felt like it was good training just for that foundation. And then I've taken classes at the Natural Gourmet Institute in New York as well, over the years, but, really, I just wanted that foundation, so I felt like I was confident in the kitchen and confident instructing other people.
Mm-hmm. And where are you based out of?
I'm in Connecticut. I'm in the Hartford area. I travel pretty much all over the state, and certainly, as you mentioned in the intro, I give, you know, presentations. I speak at events all over the country, essentially.
Uh-huh. And so when you first went to culinary school, you were not just cooking vegan then, or were you only cooking vegan and yeah, you took the whole course?
Yeah, so I was eating vegan, but of course the culinary training includes everything. But, you know, I fortunately, in most cases, you could work with a partner. So I would let my partner do some of the cooking of foods that I didn't want to cook. But, you know, still I'm learning about the flavors and the techniques, and that was important to me.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get started with the personal chef service that you run? Well, on
right.
Meals.
So, yeah, so this kind of evolved from that experience. When I started eating healthy and veganizing my food and sharing it with people, they said, wow, this is really delicious. You should open
is
a restaurant.
Veganizing so an actual verb?
I think it is now. It might be in the dictionary. but, right, you know, taking traditional foods, taking the animal products out and
right.
substituting plant-based versions of ingredients. So, you know, using tofu often for a meat substitute and pureeing the silken tofu to make cream sauces. And then since then learning, you know, soaking cashews and almonds and that you can puree
right.
them to make the white sauces, things like that, that you just kind of pick up along the way. So then I just when I decided I didn't want to open a restaurant, since I was a teacher at the time, I thought, well, combine the two passions and teach adult education cooking classes. So that's what I started doing in the Hartford area. I was teaching one class a semester, and it was really, for me, I felt like it's just for fun and education, so I can share what I knew. Again, back then, there were maybe one or two, you know, vegan restaurants in the area, and now they seem to be popping up everywhere, which is amazing. But I wanted to, you know, that whole idea of teaching people how to cook so they can feed themselves every day, you know, mm-hmm. for the rest of their lives, and that message, I wanted to get the ethical message across. And so I started teaching the cooking classes. And then one of the students in my classes really enjoyed the food that I was eating and asked if I would cook for her. And at the time, I didn't think, you know, that would become my business or my focus in life. But she was my first client. And then word of mouth, I just started getting more clients. And again, working with other people, I've consulted with restaurants to help them develop vegan items for their menus. I've worked in schools teaching students how to eat healthy and also the food service, how to cook healthy vegan foods. I give a lot of public presentations at libraries, and really just I want to spread that message to as many people as possible in the general public.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about your new book, Eat Vegan With Me, Creating Community Through Conversation and Compassionate Cuisine.
Yes, this evolved over the years. My first cookbook, Easy Peasy Vegan Eats, came out in 2014. I self-published that because of all the recipes I was developing in the cooking classes, and everyone kept saying, when are you going to have a cookbook? Of course, I'm sure you hear that all the time,
right.
too. And, you know,
uh-huh. And I'm working on mine as well.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
So I did that cookbook. And then the other thing that came up in conversations when I would give presentations is people would say they love the food. You know, I would share samples of recipes or I'd do a demonstration and they'd try some of the food and they'd say, this is delicious. I love it. I can see myself do it. But then they'd say, what about my family? They're not behind it. And that kept coming up as an issue that people were struggling with support from family and friends. So that, to me, felt like an area that needed to be addressed in, you know, in the vegan world of publishing. So I initially kind of looked at it as not really a cookbook, but more of a self-help or a support book for vegans that are the only vegan in their social circles. But, of course, everyone wants recipes. So it developed into a cookbook. So it's a little bit of both. It's half self-help about, you know, what you can do as the lone vegan or how to get the message and become what I call an everyday activist within your social circles, and then how to share familiar yet fabulous recipes. So the kinds of recipes that people might already be eating, like as I mentioned, lasagna was a big thing in my family, and then to veganize those traditional favorites so that people don't really feel like they're missing anything. And that's the focus of the cookbook.
Mm-hmm. So in the book, you talk about how important it is to converse in a positive way with the non-vegan eaters in your circle. Can you touch on that a little bit? Tell us what, you know, what you focus on in the book with that.
Yes, I feel that's so important to always stay positive and to not feel like you're being attacked. I think that, you know, I'm not trying to blame the victim and say that, you know, we as vegans are negative, but I think I probably felt a little bit that way too, a little defensive at first and trying to explain to people what to me seems so obvious. But then you have to realize not everybody knows this and not everybody sees this as so obvious. So then I kind of shifted my mindset and to see that every time somebody says something sarcastic or says something potentially trying to challenge you or throw you off, that it's an opportunity for education and it takes practice, honestly. I've failed miserably in some of these conversations in the past, so I've learned from my mistakes, and that's kind of the case. It's trial and error at first, and then the more you get comfortable with expressing yourself as well as expressing the ethics of veganism, and that I think to me is very important. At first, I think, as I said, I was more doing it for health reasons, so I looked at it as a diet, and I think it's more acceptable in our society to see it as a diet, and people can support you in your dietary change, but when they see it as an ethical change or when they see the ethics behind it, that often has a lot of difficulty with all the associations in our, you know, as Melanie Joy says, the natural, normal, and necessary. I think it does confront a lot of those beliefs that people have developed through social assimilation into what is acceptable. But so it is about that, recognizing where everyone's coming from and trying to be respectful, but also to be assertive in stating what you feel is important too. And I think that's key, is to not look at it as being confrontational, but you're informing and you're being assertive and you're being honest and respectful in the way that you present the information.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's so important. I also, you know, have found that in my years of eating mostly plant-based foods, you know, people are very protective of their food choices and are very passionate about it. The same way we're passionate about being vegan, someone's passionate about, you know, their meat. And, you know, and what do you say to someone, you know, when they say, well, I only buy meat that's raised, you know, sustainably, you know, what do you say to someone who would come back with that answer to you?
I would say, unfortunately, there is no such thing as sustainable animal agriculture. And I would explain that right now our resources are so limited. The land resources, we're destroying the rainforest. I can't remember the statistic. I know in Cowspiracy, Will Tuttle says it might be like an acre every second of rainforest. Don't quote me on that, but I know it's an extreme amount of land that's being destroyed to have grazing, you know, areas for grazing for animals, as well as to grow the crops to feed the animals. So we don't have the land resources. The water is getting polluted because of animal agriculture. And that, you know, if you think about it now, we've got about 7.5 billion people in the world and 75 billion animals are killed every year to feed them. And then the predictions for the future with the increased population on our planet, it's just already unsustainable, and it's just going to get worse. So there is no such thing as sustainable animal agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Yep, I agree with you. Anyway, let's take a couple-minute break. When we come back, I want to delve into, you know, some of your favorite recipes and also talk about, you know, some of the initiatives that you see happening. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Mary Lawrence from Eat Vegan With Me. Be right back.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
I'm Eric Davis, and I want to invite you to join me for Expanding Mind, a show that features conversations about the cultures of consciousness. magic, meditation, neuroscience, religion, technology, psychedelics, weird media. Expanding Mind is devoted to changing your perspective without insulting your intelligence. Tune into the Progressive Radio Network every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And check out the archive page for Expanding Mind on PRN.FM. And remember, keep your minds open.
Progressive Radio Network is now on iTunes. Search for us to listen and download past shows or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Are you interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest, Mary Lawrence, is with me. She's the author of Eat Vegan With Me, Creating Community Through Conversation and Compassionate Cuisine. Mary, are you there?
I am there, yes.
Great. So what do you think are some of the biggest obstacles people face when contemplating becoming vegan?
Well, some of the things we already mentioned is just society and the way we've been acculturated to believe that eating meat and dairy are required for our health, that it's natural, it's normal, and necessary. Really, I think about the government with the food pyramid, and now we have My Plate, which fortunately is making a little bit of a shift, but still, I think there is that message that you need to get protein, you need to have meat to get protein, that you need to drink cow's milk in order to get calcium. So those myths are so embedded in our society and the way people are raised. And I think, unfortunately, in our education system, it's a problem I discuss all the time, that the message that children get, if anything, as far as like eating healthy, that, you know, if they have the lunch program, they're given the milk with their meals. The meals are usually centered around some meat, and it's usually something not too healthy, like hamburger or hot dogs.
Or chicken nuggets.
chicken nuggets, right. So all that processed food is also acculturated into our belief system, that is, as if that is healthy for us. I teach English part-time. Still, even though I run my business, I also teach English. And one of my students, this is in at a community college in New Haven, inner city school, and the majority of my students are of color. And one of my students, a young woman, said that she was raised ever since she was 2 years old to think that chicken McNuggets are healthy, that when you go to McDonald's, you need to get the meat, and then you need a milkshake to go with that to get the calcium. And she said that's all she ate ever since she was 2 years old, was essentially the animal products from McDonald's, and thinking that's healthy. And this message, unfortunately, because of watching TV, that's what you see, the advertisements for all the fast food restaurants. And that's what you assume is your only option. And especially, and that may be the case for people like many of my students. They don't have cars. They take the bus everywhere. They're working often part-time or even full-time jobs in addition to taking classes, and then some of them have families of their own to raise, and they don't have the time, they don't have money. So it's a convenience factor that people just are eating what they can eat. So I think all of those obstacles of advertising, the meat and dairy industry, and our American culture believing that meat is what's good for you. Meat and dairy are what are good for you. Those are the major obstacles I think people face. And then, of course, the social environment of family and friends that have the same belief systems or the, you know, it's hard to say belief systems, but it's the misbelief or the misconceptions mm-hmm. that are really fed to us since we're young children. So our entire lives are based on these this misinformation. So to try to overcome that, it's very challenging as individuals, and particularly once we're vegan, to overcome that within our social circles. And that's why it is important to have the facts so that you can, have a few good websites you can refer people to, like nutritionfacts.org or PCRM, so people can get the nutrition information from the plant-based health perspective, because, of course, we've got the MyPlate government version, but PCRM, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, has the PowerPlate, and I think that sounds so much better, the PowerPlate version, which is all on plant-based sources of the nutrition. So I always recommend that. And then, of course, you know, the environmental connection, Cowspiracy, is a great resource for that. And, oh, speaking of which, during our little break, I did look it up, and it is the rainforest is getting cut down at the rate of 1 acre per second. And that is one of the facts that because of the animal agriculture industry. So it's good to be aware of these issues that we are facing in our lives. What I do also recommend is to avoid getting into arguments where you're just volleying facts back and forth, because often people will bombard you with questions, which to me just shows that they are trying to look for reasons not to be vegan. So I give them websites, and then I tell them my story. And I think the most important thing is to share the compassion aspect of the belief that it's just not right to take another living being's life, an animal who wanted to live, an animal who has the right to their own choices, and that we don't have the right to impose those choices on the other animal and by taking their lives. So to me, that's indisputable, that that it can't be argued.
Yeah. You know, I had a student who did a research paper on Burger King milkshakes, and they, you know, came back and said, you know, in a Burger King strawberry milkshake, there are no strawberries and there is no milk.
Yeah.
You know, and that
yeah.
was like a real eye opener for those that, you know, think the milk is healthy. It's like, there's no milk in there. There's
all
no
chemical,
strawberries
yep.
in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People just don't know. I mean, you know, so much of the fast food market and processed food is made in a lab, not in a kitchen.
Right.
You
yeah,
know.
I mean, really, even when I teach English, but I always talk about, you know, race, gender, environment, social justice issues. We discuss everything. And yeah, when I share that with them about processed foods, and they say, how can that be legal? How can these things
right.
be allowed? And right, that is a legitimate question. I agree with it. I don't think they should be allowed into the food system.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, I always tell people, follow the money, you know, who's supporting the research. I mean, American Dairy Association still supports health education in our public schools. So, of course, they're going to be
right.
pushing milk and telling you milk is healthy. But, you know, there's a really interesting article in the New York Times food section today about how much of our fruits and vegetables is being imported from mm-hmm. other countries. And it's just, it's shocking. You know, 99.9% of bananas, mangoes, asparagus, 95.6% of asparagus, 85.9% of avocados, all imported, you know, and it's just, you know, the in with healthy eating, there's also a local movement happening. And the more we can eat and support our local farmers as well, I think that's a really nice thing as well. Do you get into that at all? Talking about local and...
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's so important. This past weekend, I spoke at the Northeast Organic Farming Association conference, which is an organic farming association, and not obviously not vegan, but I did speak about veganism. And yes, definitely there's the movement for local, for organic, to grow your own, and really I think this is so key. If you can, I know, again, this is like kind of limits the potential for who can do it. But even if it's just a pot of herbs, even if it's sprouting seeds, you know, to do as much as you can yourself to add to your own nutrition, because the food is the freshest when, as you know, I'm sure I heard you talking about the gardening in your opening, mm-hmm. and, you know, planting the peas. I'm so looking forward to that, too. Of course, we have snow on the ground still, but as soon as possible, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting in the dirt and planting peas and greens. And then I eat them all through, like, spring and summer and fall. That's really, I'm in my garden trying to eat as much as I can. And I always talk about wild foraging as well. When you know what plants are safe to eat, and really dandelions grow in pretty much everyone's yard, and most people want to get rid of them, but I say, no, let them grow, because dandelion greens are some of the most nutritious foods there is.
Right, right.
And really, free food is everywhere if you know where to go. And that's, I teach classes on that as well, because I do think, you know, for people that have limited financial resources, to be able to eat healthy is a very big challenge in our society. So foraging is a way to get around that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, you started the Green Party Animal Rights Committee. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm a member of the Green Party, and what interested me was the environmental connection, because it seemed like neither of the, you know, larger two parties were addressing that issue. So the Green Party is very much about environmental justice, social justice as far as, you know, workers' rights, human rights, ending the prison industrial complex, things like that, that really appeal to me. But there seemed to be a lack of addressing the animal rights issue. So that was the area that I wanted to focus on, to get that message within the party. So it was over maybe a year and a half period of working to establish that. But in 2016, we created the Green Party Animal Rights Committee, and there are members across the country, and I think we have 29 states that are represented right now. So trying to get involved with local politics, you mentioned local food, but certainly local politics is key. Within each state, getting involved with government protections for animals, for legislation to, you know, to protect animals. And here in Connecticut, I worked with some local animal activist groups, and we established a year ago, passed into law, Desmond's Law, which is giving legal representation to animals that are involved in cruelty cases. So anytime there's a cruelty case and somebody is, you know, in court, or sometimes it doesn't even go to court, often they just get released, or it doesn't, you know, they don't get any probation or anything like that. So this new law, Desmond's Law, gives the animal representation, because there's nobody otherwise to argue for the animal in court. And then it also, again, pushes for something beyond a slap on the wrist for the offenders, so that they know that animal cruelty is a serious crime. So that's really what we push for here in Connecticut, and we're trying to get this in California as well. There's a group in California that's now taking up that initiative as well, because animals, just people don't realize that, you know, average person doesn't realize that animals really have no protections in the legal system. And that, to me, is part of the problem.
Right.
Luckily we have the Non-Human Rights Project as well, a great organization that's working on the personhood for animals. And I think that would be key, when people just start seeing animals as persons rather than property. That, I think, will make a huge shift in our society.
What's that called, the Non-Human Rights Project?
Yes.
Cool. I had never heard of that. Mm-hmm. So you also started a veganic community garden. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. So as I described, I am a gardener, and I love getting out in the dirt, and I like teaching people about gardening. And it had bothered me for a while to realize that, you know, often we put compost in our yard, we get the bad compost, but it has manure, and that manure is coming from factory farms. Often the factory farming industry, you know, they develop a lot of waste products, and they don't know what to do with it. So they use that as fertilizer for organic agriculture. And when you And it is like one of those things. You don't realize they're intricately related. The organic food industry, the large-scale organic farms are using manure from the factory farms to fertilize the soil. So to do it veganically means not to use any animal products. So I'm creating my own compost in my yard with, what's on site. So dried leaves, grass clippings, kitchen scraps, things like that, cardboard, newspaper, all that goes into my compost pile, using cover crops. So those are plants that you put in the soil and then you turn them into the soil or just let them die out at the end of the season, and that adds nitrogen to the soil. So all sorts of methods, companion planting, using a lot of mulch, like straw for mulch. All those methods can produce healthy plants and delicious fruits and vegetables, and you don't need to use any animal products, and you don't have to be tied to the animal agriculture industry. So it's a growing movement. It's kind of flourishing now. It's starting to flourish now. There's a organization called Club Veg, which has resources for starting a veganic garden, and this is something that that over like maybe the past 10 or 20 years or so, George Eisman, who was a registered dietitian vegan, involved in the vegan movement for decades, he is one that has had spearheaded this movement for veganic gardening. So I'm trying to carry on in that approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so the community.
What about if
garden,
people get, horse manure, that from, local farm, local barn,
right,
near your house?
Right. And I think it's
how do you feel about that?
I think it's that same question. People would say, well, what about local? My neighbor has chickens and they give me their eggs. Is that okay? So this is when I say, I explain what vegan is, not using any animal products. And there's different levels. Some people will say, if you take the neighbor's eggs and then you feed them to your dog or, whatever, different levels of vegan and what your comfort level is. I personally don't, and I personally would say that is not veganic. So that's my perspective. If a neighbor has horse manure, then maybe they can start a garden with the horse manure, using that for fertilizer, or they can just, clean the stalls and then just, leave the manure. I don't know anything about maintaining horse barns, but, leave that in the field, perhaps.
Because, I'm just wondering, because, horses are vegetarian as well, vegan,
mm-hmm.
basically. And so, my girlfriend just has so much poop she has to deal with all the time with her horses. And, I get it over here sometimes, and I let it sit for, 6 months or a year before I add it to my mm-hmm. compost, but that's the only manure that I'm using. But mm-hmm. I guess I've been using that.
Yeah. So if you're comfortable, and I'd say it's still an organic garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you also talk about vegans becoming everyday activists.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
In having these conversations that we often have with people, and certainly it happens when you declare yourself vegan. Once somebody knows that you're vegan, then you often get bombarded with questions. And so being that everyday activist, it's the opportunity to educate, to share what you know with others. I don't want to make anyone feel like they have to do anything confrontational. Like, you don't have to go out and be at a protest. You don't have to do a demonstration. Sometimes people are just not comfortable doing that, and I completely understand that. So in these everyday interactions we have with people, even when you're going out to a restaurant, I always say to say to your wait person that you're vegan, and if you explain what it is, then that also is an opportunity to educate, rather than say, I can't eat dairy or I can't eat eggs. And that's what I used to do, because at first I didn't call myself, I didn't refer to myself as a vegan, because I wasn't quite sure what I wanted, if I wanted to do that. But once, as I said, once I got involved with the ethical reasons for being vegan, then I did feel like it was part of my mission in life to educate others. So that's why I do say the V word. And I always say that in my, when I give presentations, to don't be afraid to call yourself vegan, to let others know what vegan is if they ask. And even just that, going to a restaurant, going to a grocery store, any kind of interaction when you're asking about the food, you know, ask if it's vegan. So that way it gets that message across to others that there's somebody that is vegan and that this is an important issue to be aware of. And then it also teaches people what it is. And if you can do it in a positive way, then the third thing is it reinforces that vegans are, you know, positive people.
And do you see any difference between calling yourself a vegan versus, you know, I am on a plant-based diet? Is it, you know?
Yes. Yes, because
share
I
that
do
with
think
us.
Just that, yeah, so calling yourself vegan normalizes the word vegan and gets that into the collective consciousness that vegan is some, you know, a person or a concept or a movement, but something that is recognizable and is acceptable. So I do think that's really important. I think it's fine if people are plant-based or if they're saying they're on a plant-based diet, but as I mentioned before, that certainly makes it more acceptable because people can don't feel that confrontation, don't necessarily feel challenged when you say plant-based, because then they start
right.
talking about their keto diet or their gluten-free diet. It's easier. So it's more polite, I think, to say plant-based. And while I understand that it's important to interact in a positive way in our society and to have good communication, I think we can also do that by saying we're vegan. So that's why I would just say, you know, to not be afraid of using the V word.
Well, Mary, we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you so much. And before we go, would you just share with everyone your website so that they can find you?
Thank you, too. It's wellonwheels.com, and you can find information about me and where I'll be, and I hope to see everybody in person or online. We'll connect.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining me. And everybody out there, thank you so much for tuning in. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.